Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Is bumping. That means it's time. Wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we are so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC, especially if you are one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. We're going to be with you in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes with gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our sponsors this week: Mack Weldon, Blue Apron, and Gamefly. They make the show possible, bringing it to you. DLC, of course, the show, all about games, and there are many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. And I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I'm joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis, the guy who still believes in magic, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. This is a weird thing because not everyone can do this, but if you have the opportunity to see magic with Jeff Cannata, do it. It makes it, like, I love magic, but magic with Jeff is 100 times. He squeals. He gets giddy. If he gets called up on stage, which apparently always happens, he looks like a plant because he's so presentational with everything. The show was great, but you were the best part of it, sir.
Christian and I and our lovely wives went and saw Magic this weekend, and it was great, man. I got pulled up on stage, and I always want to be like the best person for them. I just want to be
so fake.
On my best behavior. You know, some people go up there and try to mess it up or whatever. I just want to be exactly what they're hoping for. Oh, man. Oh, we got a lot of video game talk to get through today, and we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know that DLC is always your downloadable Cannata and your downloadable Christian, but this week DLC stands for Downright Likeable Confection, because we have the cynical Brit himself, Total Biscuit, is with us for the first time. Hello, Total Biscuit.
Hello, Jeff. Much appreciated. Thank you very much for the wonderfully professional introduction, something I'm very much not used to in the, let's just say, the run of podcasts that I'm usually involved in.
Well, we'll see if we can maintain our professionality. Well, you know, it's a declining slope from here on out, but I appreciate you being with us. We got a lot of really cool stuff to talk about this week, some great games and some interesting news. So let's get right to it. We'll start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the week, it's the story of the week. Story of the week, it's the story of the week.
Story of the week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. And you can always submit stories for our consideration using our hashtag on Twitter, that's DLCSOTW, or by visiting our subreddit, which is 5x5dlc.reddit.com. Great group of people there. You can always submit stories, talk about the episodes, whatever you want to do. Cool folks hanging out. TB, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Ooh, that's an interesting one indeed. I think a lot of the usual controversy that tends to arrive on a year-to-year basis has managed to drop itself on our doorstep this week, however, since we've got some official confirmation about this year's rendition of Call of Duty. That being the confirmation of the World War II setting, the announcement of a reveal coming in the next couple of days, that being on April the 26th. It's going to be Sledgehammer heading it up this time around. And sparse details otherwise, outside of perhaps what we would have expected. Normandy D-Day landing being portrayed for perhaps the 50th time in video game history and all that sort of thing. A standalone co-op story will also be thrown into the mix, as well as the multiplayer, which will be interesting to see what they decide to do with that, since we've had about four games worth of jetpacks.
Yeah, I'm very curious, you know, in a slippery slope that they've gotten to with fast running and wall running and double jumping and, you know, very arcadey multiplayer. How do you force that community to take a step back and say, okay, we're in World War II now, where human beings were human? That's going to be, I think, an adjustment. But of course, this is back to the roots of what Call of Duty was. It originally was that kind of an answer to Medal of Honor back in the early 2000s. And it really was centered on creating the experience of the greatest generation. And the modern warfare and the infinite warfares have spun it off in a completely different direction. But I'm wondering what you think of returning to its roots. Are you excited for a World War II setting for Call of Duty?
I don't want to say I'm necessarily excited. I think there's a lot of room in that particular space for creativity, but I don't think that Call of Duty is necessarily the franchise to bring that degree of creativity to it. Mm. We've already seen perhaps just how mundane a very interesting setting like World War I can be made when DICE decides to essentially make it World War II in a slightly rustier skin. And I am not 100% convinced that we'll see truly interesting exploration of World War II. And honestly, the original Call of Duty was so very, very good at that, particularly when it came to hitting the beats of various famous war movies. A lot of material from Enemy at the Gates in the original Call of Duty, Bridge Too Far, and a few other classic war movies.
Saving Private Ryan, of course.
Indeed, yeah. Essentially, I mean, I wouldn't say they were inspired as much as we straight up ripped this from the movie.
Right.
Put it into a video game. But at the time, there was nothing that immersive. I recall when Call of Duty first came out, playing it on my PC with a 5.1 system and being blown away. I'd never experienced sound design like that in a game before. And despite how scripted it was, it didn't matter. The fantasy, the immersion into that battlefield was so far beyond anything else that had really come before, that's what made the game stand apart. Yeah. But these days, that's not really what defines Call of Duty as a series. The single player is something of a throwaway. It's expected, but never necessarily exceptional. The multiplayer is the big selling point, and it will be interesting to see that go back to the closer to the boots on the ground sort of approach, and who will receive that well and who won't.
Yeah, I think people don't remember well the uproar that happened when they announced Call of Duty was going to go into modern times, and people were like, "Well, that will even work? Yeah. This is a World War II series. You're ruining it." And it's funny that now we're back in the other way around. Christian, what do you think about this? I personally am excited for a standalone co-op campaign. I think that sounds really cool. It's not just play through the single player with a buddy. It's here's a whole different co-op campaign, which I think leads to the fantasy of like Band of Brothers style camaraderie in World War II. Are you excited for this, or do you think that there, you know, isn't much new ground to be tread in this milieu?
I think it's easy to pile on, you know, the annual Call of Duty release, but there's a lot of content on that disc, or it's not really on the disc, and then you download the rest of the content. What I'm saying is, though, but for your money, there's a lot there, whether or not it's for
you and you
like it, you know, I can't argue that for you. But, you know, maybe the campaign's only 4 hours long. Okay, fine. But then you're going to have a standalone co-op campaign. That's another little chunk. And then there's the multiplayer. And then is there going to be some variation of zombies again or whatever that is? So I think for fans of the series, I think it's easy to be excited about it again. And in World War II games have this nostalgia to them now, because it's either the games that when you were really little, you saw maybe your older sibling playing, or the big kids at school and you weren't quite allowed to play it yet. You know, it's like the thing that you heard about before maybe you were gaming, and now this is your turn to go through it, because we're all older fellows and it's like, oh, Halo, of course Halo's going to be huge or whatever. But most, I don't want to say most, a lot of people playing video games now, you know, weren't playing video games when Halo 1 came out or when Call of Duty 2 came out. And so this is their chance to have that epic World War II experience. And I think even if it's, you know, rehashing some of the same battles done with today's technology and maybe from someone 5 meters down the beach, you know, you can still have an interesting and compelling story. I think Sledgehammer's done great work with the franchise. I remember before, it's like everything with this franchise, right? When something new comes in, it's like, oh, this is going to be the worst. Black Ops is the only way that works. And then it's like, oh, World War II again, they're never going to pull this off. I have faith in them that they're going to pull it off. I imagine it will be a pretty solid game. The thing that they need to hammer out is that multiplayer, because year after year, that's the thing that, you know, sinks or swims in terms of longevity for each of these releases. And last year's game, I loved the single player, but the big multiplayer fans, you know, didn't like it. And I think you hit it on the head, Jeff. Like, how do you scale back that movement and momentum for people that now have had 4 years of wall running and double jumping to, you're back in the trenches? And I don't know how they're going to do that. Maybe there will be a future mode in multiplayer. Like, these games never have to gel, you know, between modes. Yeah. So we'll
it's see. Interesting that that Sledgehammer is the one in control of this, because their last game, of course, was Advanced Warfare, which I praise to the high heavens for really taking risks with the movement system. It was the most advanced movement system Call of Duty's ever done, and they've scaled back on that over the last couple of games, particularly because console multiplayer gamers had some complaints about how difficult it was to constantly move in the most efficient way possible. You had a jump jet with almost zero cooldown, you had air dashes with controllable direction, as well as wall running, sliding, and everything else. That, to me, says an old-school Tribes player, was phenomenal. I was extremely entertained by that. I think it was the best movement system they've ever done. But over the last couple of games, they've scaled it back a bit because, yeah, some people didn't like that. And now the studio responsible for the most advanced movement system is going back to an era where they really shouldn't be able to do any of that.
Interesting. Yeah, it's going to be it's really all about, is the community going to embrace it? Because it seems like the community just decided they didn't want Advanced Warfare. They didn't want, Infinite Warfare. They didn't want the future, and for whatever reason.
Though, was in intricacies that you or I didn't know or experience, but it was very kind true. Of in the leveling and the microtransactions or the perceived, you know, value of how your rewards for playtime that, at least, Jeff, you and I, we're not in the scene enough to know, oh, this is that different. Right. But I think that was a big pushback to, in the maps, not feeling as fun or efficient or have the sight lines and stuff like that. Like, there's a community that knows this stuff, and I'm not it.
I'm not either. But it's interesting to see from the outside the complaints that come from that group of people and what the competitive Call of Duty community wants versus what the more casual Call of Duty community would want, which is a market that represents untold millions of people. Evidently, we did see a drop in sales around Infinite Warfare. To some extent, that was a shame. I think it was the best campaign they've done in ages, honestly, and that comes from somebody that doesn't generally enjoy Call of Duty campaigns, simply because they're very short, very scripted, and compared to something amazing like Doom or Wolfenstein: The New Order, it's hard to put Call of Duty up against that and say that it's worth playing. But their concerns about the multiplayer were completely different to mine. They were talking about things like, say, there was an in-depth crafting system in the multiplayer aspect of Infinite Warfare that I didn't even touch. But that was an interesting piece of innovation that obviously split the player base down the middle as to whether they wanted it or not. And then perhaps you have this lapsed player base that would come back for a more classic Call of Duty experience, as opposed to the one that buys it on a year-to-year.
Yeah. Well, we'll know more on Wednesday, and we'll be talking about it again next week, I'm sure. Christian, what is your story of the week?
Well, so last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, I got to pay for my daughter's college with the discontinuation.
Longer ago, but it was just last week.
It was just last week, right. Yeah. Well, you haven't been able to find them for longer than that.
It's the mysterious Ark of the Covenant, also known as the NES Classic, right?
Yeah, it's harder to find, I think, even than the Ark.
Supposedly, there were some at Best Buy this morning.
Were you willing to play Battle Royale to get one?
No.
The rumor is now, I think this is out of Eurogamer, and you know, they've had some pretty legit leaks and rumors come through, so it's not as if it's like from fansite geocities.1, but the rumor is the Super Nintendo Mini is launching this holiday, which to me is exciting because it's one of my favorite consoles of all time. But how are you going to launch this thing on the heels of this other thing that people weren't able to get and is currently, I think, on eBay for $250?
Like, more than that, even.
It's mind-boggling, right? Like, when, like, the attraction to resellers, scalpers. I tried to combine the two words into resellers. I just don't know. I don't know how Nintendo in good conscience puts this thing out and how anyone's going to be able to get one. And I'm so excited, but I'm so scared, guys. I'm so scared.
I mean, no, Christian, it's an assumption that they have a conscience.
That's a good point. And, you know, Nintendo started as a collectibles company, right? They know how to create demand for collectibles. And I don't think that it's lost on them that the scarcity of the NES is the perfect advertisement for the SNES Mini. And maybe,
I should report that I'm already in line for one. I'm
okay,
doing this from
reporting
outside
from
Best
the
Buy,
line. Yeah. I'm much more excited about this than I ever was for the NES Mini. I just have much more affinity for the 16-bit era and for the Super Nintendo as a console. I think it is one of the greatest libraries of any console ever, and really can do some fun stuff with this thing. But yeah, I mean, are you going to have more than 15 of them nationwide? You know, I don't know.
It's a good question, isn't it? Are they even going to be able to keep up with Switch demand by then? The rumors were that the NES Classic was discontinued because they needed the production space on the production lines to build more Switches. Whether that's true or not, who really knows? But if you're going to put a big push out for Christmas for the Switch, which one assumes that you are, you're going to need all hands on deck for that. But then you're also throwing out a mini Super Nintendo as well around that time. I can't be the only one to believe that Nintendo might not be up to the task of making sure that those are properly stocked. And yeah. I think you hit it right on the head by saying that there is an affinity for the 16-bit era for a very good reason. The games were better. It's as simple as that. If you ask me, are there 30 NES games that you would sit down and willingly play right now if not compelled by another person to do so? The answer that I would have would be no. But there are definitely 30 or even more besides Super Nintendo games that I'd willingly play now, especially if they happen to get something absolutely killer onto that, like Super Mario RPG, which would be licensing hell, but they managed to get some non-Nintendo IP onto the NES Classic. You know, if they got just one really great title onto the Super NES Classic, or whatever they're calling it, the Super NES Mini, it would be a massive seller, no doubt.
I think it's going to be a massive seller either way. It doesn't even matter what they put on. If they put on Super Mario World, it'll be a massive seller.
It's a great game.
Fortune
tellers here. We're going to look into our crystal balls and say, one, does it come out holiday 2017? And two, what is its MSRP? Not what will you need to pay to get one. What is the retail price for one of these? The NES Mini was $60. So TB1, does this come out holiday 2017? And if so, what is its retail price?
I'll say yes, it does, because Nintendo has not demonstrated the capability for common sense over the last few years. So yes, it will come out at that time. And I'm thinking $99.99 for something like that.
Something
a little bit more expensive.
I think those are two pretty solid predictions. I think it will come out this holiday, if you define come out as a few people will be able to get it.
Like one is released.
By the strict definition of the word coming out, yes.
And I do think it will be more expensive than the NES Classic. I think $100 is probably pretty right on. Maybe 80, if they're being generous. But it seems like they realize they could charge more for these things.
They absolutely can, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they could go $150, but then it's like, at what point do they encroach on this? I just feel like this is a year they don't need it. Last year, it kind of made sense. The Wii U was, you know, done. The Switch wasn't quite out yet. This year, Mario should be coming out, hopefully. Switches are still relatively hard to find. Zelda's still an incredible game that not everybody's played, even though more people own Zelda than own Switches. Part of me, and I have a pretty good prediction record going, so I'm hesitant to say it. I'm going to go out on the limb and say this doesn't come out this year. I think they're going to hold off on it. Maybe it's ready. Maybe they had it ready to go in case the Switch kind of tanked. But my guess is it doesn't come out. But if it does, it's that $100 price point, right? It has to be more than the other one. But that still
is
going to fly off shelves if it comes out.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I want to tell you guys, because the Full Throttle remaster came out this week, I was kind of digging through my old files, looking for my old reviews of games, because I reviewed Full Throttle back in the day, in the 90s, when I was a like 14-year-old video game reviewer for the newspaper. And I found my old review. I didn't find Full Throttle, sadly, but I found my review of ActRaiser.
Oh,
which
my.
I gave a 9 out of 10, and it makes me want an ActRaiser for this thing. But you need to put ActRaiser on the Super Nintendo. It was such a great game.
It's been a long time since I played that one, but it had some incredibly unique ideas. It was sort of back in the time, especially with Squeenix, where they were...
They weren't Squeenix yet. They were just Enix.
No, they weren't. Yeah, then they weren't concerned about your petty concepts like genres. They just took a bunch of mechanics and themes that they thought would be cool and threw them together, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't.
Yeah, it was Enix had not been purchased by Square yet, so it was just Enix.
I think the golden age of gaming, don't get me wrong, I love this year and last year, but like there was that era of gaming where I do feel like it was a bunch of, you know, kids sitting around a boardroom being like, okay, what about this? A huge sword. Do it! What should the hair be like? We have 10 options. Purple one. How do they get around? I don't know. Motorcycles. Check.
Yeah, there was... Whatever.
Are there dragons in this world? Of course there are dragons! Don't be an idiot, Bart!
Awesome. So my story of the week is this interesting thing that Valve is doing with Dota 2, where they're trying to curb smurfing on that game. The smurfing is the practice of people... creating new accounts, even though they have a lot of experience playing a game, but creating new accounts so that the game thinks that they are new players, and then they can get into matchmaking games and ranked play against lower skilled players because they have high skill. What's that?
I don't get that. I mean, I understand the thing. I don't get why someone would do that.
So that they can school people. So they can be. It's kind of cheating, right? It's saying I'm awesome. The game knows I'm awesome, but I can trick the game into thinking I'm not awesome so I can play people much lower skill level. It's like going to the kindergarten.
It's Billy Madison.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's going to the kindergarten and challenging the kids to a game of basketball. You know,
it's what bizarre.
Yeah.
There's a couple of legitimate reasons that have been bandied around for doing it, and they're fairly situational ones. In the case of a very high-level player, especially one that happens to be playing on a pro esports team, the queuing times for those of similar MMR ranking are absurdly high, to the point where if somebody just wants to play a pickup game of Dota and you happen to be that good, I hope you're ready to wait in a queue for 2 hours.
Yeesh.
And at that point, they'll often run a smurf. League of Legends has a similar problem. I believe Counter-Strike has a similar issue, but perhaps less terrible simply because of the length of the matches. But I've heard of pro players running smurfs for that reason. Also, they would run smurfs to play with, say, followers and fans on streams.
Right.
Because, of course, you don't want to be 8K MMR and then drag, like, Billy just got his new Dota. He wants to play with his favorite player. And it just gets destroyed to the point where his mortal soul has been expunged from this realm. There's a couple of legit reasons. You know, another one being that maybe you do feel like you're being put up against players who are just way better than you. You've been maybe put into a bracket that you're uncomfortable playing in, and rather than waiting for the system to figure it out, you'll start a new account and hope that you get put in with guys that are closer to your skill range a little bit quicker.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you are right. It is going to the kids' basketball court as a 6'8", you know, amateur athlete and just schooling them on it. It's not a good practice.
I have the opposite inclination because I play a lot of Heroes of the Storm, and I feel like my MMR is a lot lower than it would be if I started today. And I feel like if I started a fresh Smurf account, I would actually get ranked higher than I...
It's entirely possible.
So anyway, the news story here is that Valve wants to reduce the behavior, and in doing so, or in their attempt to do so, is to require ranked players to register their account with a unique telephone number.
Mm-hmm.
So that theoretically you can only have one account per person per telephone number.
Per burner phone. Yeah.
Well, I guess burner phone would be untraceable. But there's some weird thing in this story that blows me away that they say online phones like Google Voice will not be allowed. Like, how do they know? I guess there's a range of numbers that Google uses?
I believe that's how it works, yeah. If I recall correctly, it's a similar situation with Skype when you get a Skype-in number. Looks very similar to a regular phone number, but I think they bought certain blocks of numbers to use especially bearing in mind that those numbers disappear and get reassigned all the time because of sure. people deciding, hey, I don't need this anymore, I'm going to cancel my sub. So I imagine they know what ranges they are and they detect them that way. The issue more so than anything is not burner phones, but burner SIMs, particularly in countries where a lot of phones are driven from SIM. The US, less so, I would say. Most phones these days maybe have SIM support, but I know a few years ago they didn't. You guys weren't able to just swap a SIM card around.
Right.
But in a lot of European countries and South American countries, Latin countries, swapping a SIM card, that's a $2 job. And you can right. do it very quickly, change your number very quickly. But honestly, the point of this is not to stop it entirely. There's no one-stop solution to everything when it comes to this kind of cheating. They want to make it just difficult enough that the majority of people won't bother.
Yeah, and Valve acknowledges that too. They said they just want to add enough friction to reduce the activity. My question to you guys is, and TB, why don't you hit this first? Do you think this is a positive thing? Do you think these kinds of proactive measures are good for the gaming community?
I think so. I think that smurfing in general as a practice is not something that is generally considered a good thing. There's a lot of complaining about that. It adds a great deal to the negativity and perceived negativity of a games community like that. It may be less of a problem than it actually is, but if the perception of that community is that smurfing is a major issue and it's actually directly affecting their enjoyment of the game, then obviously their player retention is going to go down. So taking any sort of proactive approach, a very public proactive approach against it, is more of reassurance for the player base, I think, more so than it is a legitimate way of getting rid of all smurfs overnight.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Christian? You got a feeling about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I talked about it on when I was streaming. I don't think it's archived anywhere, but the idea of the other, I think in video games, it's such an interesting microcosm of othering people, where when you're playing a game and if you're getting dominated, it's so easy to just make excuses or reasons for why.
Absolutely.
Oh, they're cheating. There's no way. No one can hit a shot from that. Oh, cheat. Oh, definitely a Smurf account. We're getting Smurfed, guys. We're getting Smurfed over here.
Yeah.
And not just, oh, they were better than me. And I'm not saying that cheating doesn't happen and that Smurfing doesn't happen, but I think your point to just being public about it, it's like, hey, we're going to do this, because, you know, it might be a huge problem, but if it's perceived as a huge problem, like TB said, that is the bigger issue, because then that's the news story that, you know, Kotaku runs or whatever, where, you know, any Polygon, whatever website's like,
It's not even news. It's just sort of like general psychology of the average gamer. I think you hit the nail on the head there of you just get angrier quicker because you feel like
yes.
you are not playing on an even playing field.
Yeah.
Right.
And a lot of this stuff is obfuscated in video games for legitimate reasons. Dota has taken steps towards transparency with things like making your MMR a publicly available statistic, something
right.
that you can very clearly see right off the bat. A lot of games don't do that.
Yeah,
they hide the MMR. Yeah, they don't. And as a result, I've heard a lot of people complaining, including people that I work with on a regular basis. Jesse Cox cannot stop complaining about matchmaking in Heroes of the Storm. He'll
right.
come into our little Skype group after a 40-minute game. He's like, I need to vent about this Heroes of the Storm game. Good Lord, these guys were idiots. How is this possible? And I'm being matchmade with these people. This system is terrible. It's garbage. Everything's broken.
Christian's never heard me do that.
Of course not. Why would he? That would never happen. But transparency is a good way to some extent, to try and eliminate that problem. You take away the imperfect asymmetry of information, and you take away excuses in the process.
Yeah, and I think that it would be a cool thing if it's caught on and permeated into other games. I think it shows that they care, and I think that's
yeah.
you know, goes a long way in and of itself.
I would like to say quickly, though, that I just want to point out that I've actually never been beaten by anyone who wasn't cheating in any game. I still am the best. You know, everybody that's beat me in Street Fighter, there's an asterisk by their name. Evo, I'm still the current reigning champ. So come at me. Just don't cheat, dude.
We got a lot of games to talk about coming up in the playlist, but I do want to thank our first sponsor, which is Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is the place to acquire good basics. Everybody needs this stuff, but too often it's the stuff you think about least. You go to your big box store and you wander down the aisle and you go, oh, yeah, I need some underpants. I'm going to grab a package of these. There's like 20 of them. They cost $6. They're garbage. They're priced as garbage. They feel scratchy and uncomfortable. They stink after a certain amount of time. You don't want that on you, and you're going to be wearing that more often than you're going to be wearing your cool shirt that you paid a bunch of money for, but you only wear, you know, once or twice a month. Mack Weldon is going to sell you the stuff that you should be caring about the most, and they're going to do it in a way that's easy for you and is going to give you high quality products, smart design, premium fabrics, antimicrobial stuff so it doesn't stink, comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, sweatpants, stuff that you're going to wear more often than the things you think about all the time, which is the cool shirt, the cool jeans, whatever it is. Think about this better, and you don't even have to worry about, you know, getting out of your house and going into the stupid big box store and wasting your time, and nobody wants to do that. This is shop from home, get it online, it comes in a cool package, it's really high quality. This is what you want to be doing. I'm wearing Mack Weldon's right this second. I swear, I really am. I love my Mack Weldon's. I reach for them first in the morning. Guess what? Because you listen to this show, we're going to hook you up with a deal. If you want to upgrade your wardrobe, if you want to feel better and smell better, go to MackWeldon.com, MackWeldon.com, and use our promo code, which is DLC, at checkout. You'll get 20% off. Hey, that's pretty good. DLC is the promo code. MackWeldon.com is the site. 20% off. Feel better, look better, smell better. Ooh, what you playing this? Some fun stuff coming out this week. Actually, a really big week of releases. And of course, we've had an amazing first part of the year. Total Biscuit, what is on your playlist this week?
Oh, my playlist is, let's just say, far too lengthy. There's a lot going on with it. There's a lot of stuff that I want to be playing, trying to catch up on. And it's been difficult to do that. I've had my parents over this week. They flew over from England for a little visit, which has put a dampener on my ability to catch up with any of this stuff. But regardless of that, I have been able to slide in a little bit of time, as I know, Jeff, you have as well, with the Dawn of War 3 beta.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised you said beta instead of beta.
You know, there were some words that I brought with me from England, and I decided to leave that one there because I think beta sounds silly.
Me too. Well, I'm glad we agree.
I thought that it had, so I've abandoned that one. I've adopted the colonial for that.
And let's well, just say we had USA. USA.
We've had some impact on you. I appreciate that. Dawn of War, were you a fan of Dawn of War 2?
Yes.
I know you're a big RTS guy, StarCraft 2 commentator and streamer. So what is your feeling of the beta for Dawn of War 3?
Very mixed impressions, really. And obviously, I played quite a lot of StarCraft, but I commentate an awful lot more of it on a pro level. I'm so terrible at that game. When you commentate a bunch of pro-level stuff, you become more and more embarrassed to actually play it. It just feels like this is not... I'm not used to this. I'm used to seeing something, and then when I try to implement that same thing, my fingers just fall to pieces, and it becomes a bit of an embarrassing nightmare. But I did enjoy both Dawn of War 1 and 2 for different reasons. They were very different games. Dawn of War 1 was a more traditional real-time strategy in terms of its base-building mechanics, but they pushed this idea, which was fairly unique at the time, of a more aggressive push across the map for resource control. They tried to eliminate the concept of turtling. You couldn't just sit in your base behind a layer of turrets and hope for the best. You had to go out there. You had to take those resource nodes, and they added things like morale and cover and real melee combat into the game, and that very much suited the theme, and it also made for a very interesting experience. And then along comes Dawn of War 2, which takes a lot of lessons from Company of Heroes. They think about things like cover being almost the be-all and end-all. If you're behind heavy cover, you are a living god. If you have your heavy weapons angled in the right way so that someone walks through your line of fire, those guys are going to get pinned down. You're going to have to force them to retreat, or they'll just get minced in a shower of heavy bolter fire for the Emperor, which I'm okay with, but there you go. And the single-player campaign was more of an RPG. It was more of a real-time tactics RPG than anything else, with gear and all sorts of things like that. And I did find that enjoyable.
Yeah.
Along comes Dawn of War 3, it sort of tried to strike a balance in the middle somewhere. And in some ways, I think it's having some trouble establishing its own identity. It feels a bit more, I hesitate to use the word casual friendly. It has certain connotations that perhaps I don't mean. It feels more straightforward than the previous games. They've put some very contrived mechanics into it, and I believe that they have implemented those specifically to avoid a couple of situations that are making certain people, particularly old school guys that maybe played Command & Conquer 10, 20 years ago and then said, well, I don't enjoy modern RTS because it doesn't feel like that anymore. They put a couple of mechanics in to try and coax those guys into getting bounced off. And one of those is that you have this big shield generator on the map and a giant turret that murders anything that comes anywhere near your base until you have disabled those power generators and then made an assertive assault on that turret, which even when the power generators are down, you have to work very hard to take down. So the whole idea of rushing, I suppose, is kind of out of the window for a lot of people. And they also have the phase system called escalation phases. It starts in phase one. There are certain numbers of characteristics that apply to the map, one being extremely important, that you get refunded the vast majority of the money that you spent on units when they die. So early on in the game, it's not a game killer if you lose a squad. But later on, they reduce that amount up to escalation phase 5, where you get no refunds at all. And it does seem like they're going out of their way to create a game mode that fixes that through very contrived mechanical changes rather than trying to change player behavior, I suppose, trying to educate them as to what a rush is and how to defend against it. They simply say a rush is now impossible because of these things. As an experienced RTS player, that does rub me the wrong way a bit.
Yeah, it's an odd way of going about it because it is a little on rails of, you know, you can't – we've just outlawed a certain manner of approaching this game. We've just – and as you say, it's very arbitrary. There's no – the systems are just in place to be systems. There's no really reasoning behind it. I did have a lot of fun – playing it. I think the Warhammer 40K universe is just really a fun place to be. Just the,
absolutely the
absurdity of the designs, you know, just like, yeah, does a space marine need a sword? No, but let's give them three of them. Why not? You know, it's all that like crazy Warhammer 40K stuff is great. The hero units are really cool. The game looks good. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, as somebody who has made the full transition from RTS to MOBA, it's almost hard actually to step back and go, oh yeah, I do have to command all these little units again. And I actually really loved turtling. That was like what I liked about RTS, because I wasn't a very skilled player, to be quite honest. And to be forced out of that shell, I think, is a benefit to me, but also it didn't make the game more fun. It just made me go, oh, you're forcing me to play a certain way. Okay, here I go. Mm-hmm. I'll play the way you want me to play a game. So I think mixed feelings too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like the idea of just being able to build their ultimate base and sit behind layers and layers of fortifications. The game doesn't let you do that. The base building aspect is there, and it's more advanced than it was in Dawn of War 2, where there really wasn't one. It was just this building, you tech up and research, it's all kind of from one central place. You can build buildings now, and particularly if you play the Eldar, you are encouraged to build certain buildings across the map. If you put your webway portals around the map, they give an area of effect speed bonus called Fleet of Foot, which is extremely potent. And as you go through the tech levels, you can teleport units from gate to gate. You can use the gates to reinforce your squads, and you can use the gates to cloak areas around you and things like that, which is very interesting. That's the sort of thing that's probably going to take aback a lot of these, you know, MOBA players, as it were. If they're trying to attract the MOBA crowd again, this game mode is not going to do that. Just because it has some MOBA-like objectives, that doesn't make it any less of a real-time strategy at all. It's very much a case of you got a build order, you need to take the right places at the right time, and you have to have the right units out at the right time. Because if you don't, if you get hard countered, your squad is dead quick. No doubt about it. If an assault marine squad jumps on top of your in-place Dark Reapers, those Dark Reapers have about 3 seconds to live. No doubt about it. The hero units are an interesting thing that you brought up there, because I actually ran into a turtle scenario during gameplay at one point that actually drove me up the wall. It really frustrated me. I'd taken 90% of the map. I had all these resource points. The guy was bottled in his base. The only thing keeping him in there were the fact that he has his base turrets up, which are very powerful if you get caught in them. They can eviscerate half your army. And he had his top hero unit, which was an orc Mechanaut, I believe, a Gargant. And I would take my army, I'd walk up to his base, he'd cast a few cooldown-based spells, and then my army would disappear. And he'd do this over and over again. And I rebuild my army because I had all the money in the world, but he had this hero unit that he could repair for free in his base, and I just kept throwing these units at him. I thought, oh, right, well, I've got all my anti-tank units. I know how to beat this thing. I built the perfect unit composition to do it. And then just died, just time and time and time again. I don't think that scenario is going to come up very often, but yeah. If it gets to late game, 40, 50 minutes in, when the guys hold up in his base just refusing to give up, I think you might run into a scenario where you just can't break that. There's not enough siege craft to be able to do it, I suppose.
Well, we should also mention that the beta didn't have any of the campaign mode in it.
No,
and I'm definitely interested to see what that entails, because I love that universe, and I think it would be very fun to play the campaign of that. What else is on your playlist there, TB?
I've been playing quite a lot of Battle Brothers.
I don't know that game.
Well, it is a low fantasy tactics game where you run a mercenary company, which has been devastated in a previous battle through betrayal and horrible Game of Thronesy type of things. And your three remaining mercenaries try and rebuild their company of mercenaries and take on contracts with villagers to earn money. And your mercenaries will level up and they will also gain the scars of war. You know, if you could, a guy can get his arm chopped off, and that's a permanent injury that'll affect him forever. Each person has different advantages and disadvantages. They all progress in different ways, and you have to try and scavenge them the best equipment you can. You know, rather than most tactics games where perhaps you have a force of incredible warriors, this guy has the flaming sword plus two of destiny and the shield of holy endurance. You've got maybe a pitchfork and a sackcloth and a hat that's made of straw. And that's maybe the best you can scavenge up. You're starving. You barely have enough bread to feed your company. You have to desperately take on a mission just to feed and just to get by. And there's that feeling of desperation and trying so, so hard to keep your mercenaries alive that is very compelling to me. If you've ever played a game called Mountain Blade, that is a game that's quite similar in theme and progression, but this game is a tactics game, quite similar to XCOM or Final Fantasy Tactics War of the Lions. You know, hex-based movement, action points, using terrain, all that kind of thing. It's a very compelling experience for me, especially since having your best guy just die because it got its head eaten by a dire wolf in a bad encounter. It's fun to lose. It's one of those games where it is fun to lose, and losing those characters is part of the experience.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up now. I wasn't even aware of this game, but it looks cool. It's got a kind of a little cartoony looking aesthetic, I guess.
Almost like moving little wooden miniatures on a board. Like they're only from the torso up. So
right,
it's almost,
right. Little busts of characters. Yeah,
that's exactly what it's like. Yeah, and I've had a lot of fun with that. It's a kind of game where you can get war stories. It's the same reason I like XCOM. You tell the war story of your custom named character that got through five battles by the skin of his teeth and saved the party through incredible heroism and then accidentally tripped over and fell on an arrow through his eye and died. It's that. And I love the low fantasy theme too. There are orcs, there are undead, but there's no magic as far as I'm aware. It's just those are just realities of that world. They're just dangers and you as mortal men have to deal with them.
Yeah, I've been playing Expedition Vikings. I can't talk about it yet, but I'm very excited to talk about that, because it's the same type of thing where it's like it plays like a fantasy game, but it doesn't have any – it's real-world stuff. And I think that's a cool feeling of like, oh, yeah, this is all based in sort of a grounded reality.
I love that grounded feel. Yeah. I played a little bit of Expeditions Conquistadors, which was the previous game in that series, and I'm very excited for Vikings. That I almost stuck on Conquistadors. I think Vikings is their next chance to really get me in deep.
What else you got on your playlist there? You got a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I just don't want to take too much of your time on all of this. I'd love to hear what you guys have been playing. But we have been parting it up a little bit with Use Your Words. I don't know if you've had the chance to play that one.
No, I say that to my kid all the time, though.
Indeed, you know, and it's appropriate to play with the kids as long as you put on the kid-friendly mode. Let's just say a few of the prompts are not so kid-friendly. We were playing with my family last night, and I let my son stay up. He had a first day of school today after spring break. Let him stay up to play one game. Everything was going just fine. We realized we had not turned off the less kid-friendly prompts, and we had a prompt for a really bad name for a sex toy.
Oh, boy.
And I will admit, his answer was quite funny. I will give him that. He handled it, although there were some weird looks around the room as to say, who did this? Who is responsible for this?
What did he say?
I believe he went for the grumpy donkey or something along those lines.
Like, that is so weird that it's exactly what my wife and I call it.
Hold on, I got to go register a website real quick. Got it.
GrumpyDonkey.xxx. Yeah, they've got those new domains for that kind of content now. Have you ever played any of the Jackbox games?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're great.
If you've played those, Use Your Words is like that. It's just a single game. It has four different mini games within that game that it rotates through. Designed very much so for playing in front of an audience. It has streaming capability. It has modes for that. One of the consultants on it, I believe, it's called, is it Brentalfloss is his name? He's a very popular streamer. So he consulted for them in terms of the watchability of the game. And it's a prompt-based game. They'll show you a little clip of a public domain foreign film, and then you have to subtitle one of the scenes. They'll show you a picture and say, write a news headline that's appropriate for this. And then it's vote for the funniest, essentially.
There's an old boxed game called Quip It that did the same exact thing we had a good time with. Yeah.
Yeah. They've taken a lot of those games, made them digital, using smart devices as a way to interface with them, I think is that's killer. I think that's a really great use of it. It's a great way to get around the problem of having eight people in a room and not having eight controllers. Everyone has a smartphone or a tablet or something, or even just a laptop you can use. So that's a very fun game. It's obviously going to be dependent on the quality of the audience you have, the quality of,
of course,
people you're with as to how funny it is, but very much enjoyed that. And I played a little bit of really bad chess on iOS.
I was very curious to hear about this. I saw that on your channel, and you said it is truly really bad chess.
That is exactly what it is. The guy who made it apparently is fairly similar to me, somebody who loved chess but was awful at it and realized that in the internet age, it's less acceptable to be awful at chess. I hanging around with the StarCraft scene in particular, with these competitive guys, they have a great deal of respect for chess, and they play chess to quite a high level, as you might expect. Mm-hmm. So it's like, hey, do you want a game of chess with me? I'm like, no, actually, I do not, because I know you will crush me and I will feel stupid. Really bad chess is for people like me. They give you completely unfair board configurations. The first one I played, they gave me four knights, three queens, and a rook. And you have to play with those rules. They have daily boards that everybody plays, and you have to try and beat it in the fewest moves to get on the leaderboard. You can do completely randomized. The way you balance it is, instead of making the AI worse, you give the AI worse pieces.
Hmm.
So you can give them a handicap, or you can give them a bonus, depending on how good you are. And that's a really enjoyable thing to carry around with you.
Do you think it's the kind of thing that actually will make you better at actual chess?
I think it might. What's interesting about it is it completely throws all of the openers out of the window and the usual situations that you would find yourself in chess. There's none of those. You're not concerned about your opening moves because you might have four knights.
Right.
So those opening moves are kind of out the window. It's like, well, I usually couldn't move this piece here because it will be under threat by this piece. Oh, he doesn't have that piece this game. So I'm not overly worried about his bishops because he doesn't have any. So it is interesting. I think you could learn a little, certainly. Mm.
Cool. Christian, you've been playing a bunch of adventure games, right?
Yeah, we weren't allowed to talk about it last week, and we were both provided codes for Telltale's Guardians of the Galaxy episode 1 is out, and there's a lot to like about the game. I'll say the stuff I like, and then I'll say the stuff that I say about Telltale games that I keep saying it, hoping that it gets improved next time. It is your cast of characters you know and love from the films. I feel like Guardians of the Galaxy is a very rich comic universe that most people maybe aren't exposed to. They've certainly had a great run over the past couple of years in comics that has kind of taken from the cinematic universe as well. And this is very much that. It's not, you know, a continuation of the cinematic story, but it's very much those versions of the characters that you know and love coming from there. Great voice acting, the art style in these games. It's kind of like, when Disney Infinity came out, they somehow created an art style that seems to work for every brand in some form or fashion, where you're like, oh yeah, how are they going to pull off Game of Thrones with this look? Oh, it looks good. How are they going to, there's no way they're going to be able to do a Rocket Raccoon and have Star. Oh, they look good. They look good. Like, I would buy figures of all of these characters. The voice acting's great. The episode one, it's so hard to judge, I think, where these things go.
It always is with them.
Right?
You know? In particular, Telltale do front load. You know, they usually have a big cliffhanger at the end of episode one that makes you want to buy the second. And sometimes it fizzles and sometimes it doesn't.
Right, exactly. And there's something very big and early in this one, and I won't say what it is. And when it happens, you're like, what? where does this go? And it's either something that pays off really cool, or I think, you know, check in whenever it is 3 months from now and it'll be like, what a waste. Don't play these. it did not deliver. So it's hard to give a review in that sense of the story, because you're reading one issue of a comic, you know, so to speak. And you're like, neat, here's these characters I like. They don't do much yet. but the things that continue to bother me about Telltale Games, and I don't know technically what it is, or how to fix it. It just, everything seems too long. I don't know if they need an editor to come in. There's a scene, I'll speak vaguely, where there's kind of a what appears to be a hero's entrance, where it should be, you know, here's your team, cue the music, fireworks in the background. And it kind of happens, and then they just kind of walk in slowly for like 3 seconds to, and you're like, yeah, I get it. Like, move. It's like, hey, Jeff, why don't you have a look at this menu and see what you want to order? I pick up the menu. I hold the menu. I hand you the menu. You grab the menu. You look at the menu. Oh, let's get a hamburger. You put the menu down. And I'm just like, yeah, we get it. Yeah, and I know the conversation stuff needs to be slower than, you know, like fast-paced teen drama, you know, CW TV show, because you need to listen and make decisions. But there's just something that drags between the scenes that frustrates me, and maybe I'm the only one. So if you don't have that frustration, I think you'll be very happy, you know, jumping into this universe. It's very much what Telltale does. There's not anything newer, you know, outside the box. It's like, oh no, this is an RTS. They totally change things. And the characters are, like I said, the all ones that I love, and the voice acting's great. And hopefully the story works out. Check in months from now, because right now it's too early to say.
Yep, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. There was the big cliffhanger at the end of the first episode of Game of Thrones, and a lot of that fizzled out towards the end. The whole conclusion to the story didn't end up being all that satisfying. It's a bit of a take-it-or-leave-it mixed bag with Telltale, considering how many properties they're juggling right now. But I think the biggest problem with their games is that they're just stubborn refusal, or maybe incapability to do so, considering they have so many plates in the air right now, to upgrade their engine, to move on to something that isn't horribly out of date. They're still using the same engine they were with back in the Sam and Max era, I believe.
Yeah.
It's kind of ridiculous at this point. It's looking quite dated.
Well, that's what when you see, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy Episode 1 for Xbox One, PC, PlayStation 4, iOS, Android. It's all, you know, it's day and date. And it all looks exactly the same. It's like, oh, well, okay. Maybe you're not, you know, maybe there's more that could be done here.
And there's a few stutters. I'm playing on PC. There's still a few like frame rate stutters and hiccups where, yeah, I don't know. I think I said back when the Batman Telltale game came out, like, I want Telltale to write a game and then hand it to Rocksteady, you know, to make the graphics and make the engine and play in that world. It's frustrating, and hopefully, you know, they seem to have all the money. So maybe, again, I do not develop video games, so I don't know the reality of it, but hey, do it better. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, we do have codes to give out for that game. So in the next couple of weeks, we've been giving out codes on the quick questions segment for Out of the Park Baseball. And we will be doing that this week again. But next week and beyond, we'll have more codes for more games, including Guardians of the Galaxy Episode 1. So if you want to develop your own opinion, send us a quick question at dlcfeedback@gmail.com or on the subreddit. But Christian, you've also been playing a little bit of Full Throttle Remastered, right?
Yeah, I had a real blind spot in my gaming history where I never played it. I think it was just like 95, 96. I remember it coming out, and I remember loving those games. But then I also remember being like, yeah, but like girls, you know, or whatever I was doing in my life then. And I heard the remaster was great. So I'm really enjoying it. I'm maybe only, it's not a super long game, but I'm maybe a third of the way through it so far. I actually am playing with the original graphics, but with the remastered sound. So it's like a high fidelity mix of the original voice. So it's not like re-recorded, but just much cleaner. And I have a quick trigger to switch back and forth on the graphics, where I always want to see what it look, what the new graphics look like. But I love pixel art, and I think Full Throttle's original pixel art is pretty incredible. And
absolutely.
The
Scum Engine games had in the LucasArts era stuff was phenomenal for the time, but stands the test of time to today. So more often than not, you're thinking, well, is this really a remaster rather than a coat of paint that I never asked for in the first place?
Right, and that's, I think, the interesting thing with it. It's much like the Street Fighter 2 HD remaster, and it's like a similar one that's coming out for the Switch, where it's a shiny coat of paint, but on the same pixels, more or less. So it's the same game, same engine underneath. And so sometimes, while it looks great in a still shot, the animations don't work for this really sharp HD thing where your head is up and then down, and then right and then left. But if you watch it in the original pixel art, it looks much smoother. So I usually switch when I get into a new scene into the new remastered graphics to kind of take it in and see what, you know, the change is and be like, oh, look, his chin's smaller, bigger, smaller, bigger, smaller, bigger. And then when I play the game, I play it in that pixel art. In this game,
I've been playing this game for 10 hours. 8 of those hours have been smaller, bigger, smaller, bigger.
Just pressing that button.
I mean, probably more like two of the hours, but... there's polygonal stuff in this game, and I totally didn't remember that at all. So it's this really cool, you know, you can see where games are going. It's this hybrid of pixel art and on a polygonal motorcycle, and what a beautiful hand-drawn world kind of meshing with where the future of video games are going to go. And the writing so far, again, only a third of the way through it, it's sharp, it's funny. The puzzles are of that era still, where...
That was very generous of you there. You paused for a second to say, yeah, moon logic.
Right. Well, it's hard because I played these games when I was younger, not this particular one. So I still have a fondness for that kind of thing. But I do wonder for someone that's just stumbling into it that maybe likes the Telltale games, where those puzzles, air quote puzzles, they're much lighter and much more find a key for the door. This is sometimes there's no hint. Like very early on, you need to unlock a thing, and there's no hint as to where the solve for that at all. You can talk to everyone, and they never tell you like check the bada bada, or what you need is, you know, to cook this thing. It's just click on stuff, dude.
Rub X on Y, see what happens. I used to play those games only with a walkthrough directly to hand, and I would be referring to it liberally. If I got stuck for more than 10 minutes, I'd be straight to the walkthrough. It was Discworld in particular that I don't think I ever left the walkthrough. That game made no sense. And that comes from someone that has read the vast majority of the Discworld novels. The game logic still didn't make any sense.
Yeah, but it's fun. I'm really enjoying it. It was like, I think, $11 on Steam when I picked it up that kind of first week or whatever. So I think if you're like me and you have the blind spot, Jeff, I wish you had your original review because that'd be great to compare.
It's definitely in my dad's house. I only picked like a few choice ones to bring with me to my life here in L.A. And I thought maybe that would be one of them. But I found like Super Star Wars, and I found ActRaiser, and I found there's like a bunch of Street Fighter, the console edition, and I found a bunch of stuff that I reviewed back in the day. And my ridiculously dorky 14-year-old kid photo in the newspaper that, you know, was like an advertisement to beat me up every week. So anyway, on my playlist, we already talked about some of the stuff I'm playing, but I also got a chance to try out a sort of an indie-developed role-playing game, like a Japanese-style role-playing game called Shinus the Lightning Kingdom. And it is based on a manga that I am not really familiar with, but it's this world, very vibrant, colorful world of anthropomorphized cat people and stuff. Cool looking characters, really neat designs, very manga-esque. And you start and you land in this world and you start as one character and you switch over and you eventually assemble this team that you have a number of different characters and you can constitute your three-member group that has different abilities and you're wandering around and you're getting into fights. The fights, I think, are the most important – or excuse me, most entertaining part of the game because you get into these little – it's almost like what I always wished for when I was younger. I would always say, you know, I would love to have a role-playing game, but when you get into a fight, it turns into a 2D fighter. Like it turns into Street Fighter when I get into a battle. And this game kind of does that. It's 3D, but it sections off an arena and now you have punches and kicks and blocks and dodges and some special abilities, magic that you can wield. And you're fighting what is ostensibly a three-dimensional sort of Power Stone-esque Marvel versus Capcom fight where you fight one-on-one with anybody, but you can swap in your teammates at any time. And the combat system is pretty fun in that way. And you're even if you fight a pack of enemies, you only fight them one at a time. You'll defeat one and it'll be like, okay, next one, step up. And he steps up and you fight that one. You have magic that you can shoot based on the elements. The barrier around the fighting arena, the arbitrary like beams of light that cordon off the area you're fighting in, are color-coded to the elements, so and they cycle. So you're waiting for the element that you want your mana recharged, and once that element cycles through the barrier color, you can push a button and recharge your mana. So there's kind of a unique element of timing and strategy with regard to what elements you're using and how you recharge them and where you put yourself on the battlefield to do that. And it's all real time and it's all action-y. And that stuff's pretty fun. The exploration of the world, the role-playing stuff is not as strong. The characters each have a unique ability that lets them solve puzzles, but the puzzles across the board are really banal and uninteresting. There's like one guy's special move literally is to create a heavy rock. He can manifest a heavy rock at any point if you need a heavy rock to put on a pedestal to, you know, pressure sensitive pedestal thing.
Well, so I bet Indiana Jones wishes he had that guy with him. Don't knock it till you try it, buddy.
Very oddly specific power of puzzle solving.
Yes, yes. It's very odd. It's like, you know, those Zelda puzzles where you get the box and you move it over the thing. It's like, well, this guy can create his own box. It's like,
odd. Phenomenal cosmic power.
Exactly. You need a heavy stone? I'm your guy. And then another character like has a wrench that can change the polarity of these beams, and you're creating circuits. It's all very tedious and uninteresting as far as puzzle solving goes, and I was a little disappointed by that. The game is $30. I would be – or no, $40, I think. I would be much more confident recommending it at half the price. It's not that long. It has some charm to it, especially if you're really into, you know, Japanese style manga, and the characters are fun and the storytelling is typical of that genre. It's like this comic book style, storytelling, but ultimately the game is a little thin, and other than the combat system, I didn't really love it.
Yeah. I'm looking at it. It does seem like you would have to enjoy the combat system to a fairly significant extent to really enjoy the game fully.
Yeah. Yeah, you do a lot of it, and it's cool. You know, that part is cool. It's just the rest of the world is very linear. It feels like a throwback to the old role-playing games you would find on, you know, on a Dreamcast or something. It's and that's fun. Like, that's cool that there is a throwback-y feel, but ultimately it has the flaws of those games as well. All right, that's going to do it for the playlist. I do need to thank our second sponsor, which is, I know I don't like to have favorites, guys, but I love this. Blue Apron has changed my life, and I'm not exaggerating in any way. My wife and I use it. We build our lives around Blue Apron, and that is not an exaggeration. Blue Apron delivers meals to your door. They deliver fresh ingredients and really cool meals, and really, the thing that got in the way of me cooking in my life is two things. Deciding what to cook. It was always very intimidating to like get on the internet and go, okay, chicken recipe. And there was like 4,000.
Hot dogs or
right.
Hot dogs.
Right. You would eventually just make garbage for yourself because that's easy and you just won't want to deal with it. And then the second thing was going to the grocery and getting the ingredients because invariably, I would, you know, I find a recipe where I need some parsley. So I go and I buy a bushel of parsley. And now I've got like a half cubic ton of parsley in my fridge. And I use 3 sprigs for this, you know, or whatever it is, a dozen eggs, and I only need to use 1. Blue Apron solves those problems. They have recipes for you that are awesome. They're always delicious. Last night, my wife and I made gnocchi. That was so delicious. Gnocchi. I've never made gnocchi. I made gnocchi. And it was an amazing cheese sauce. And it had roasted baby bok choy, which I love saying the word. I would never buy baby bok choy from the store. But Blue Apron delivers it to me. It delivers exactly the amount that I need. It doesn't give me extra that's going to go bad. it has great recipes. You can select different kinds of dietary restrictions. If you want to be a vegetarian, you can be vegetarian. All that stuff. You're going to eat better. You're going to know what goes in your food, and you're going to get skills. I know how to chop things now. I enjoy cooking. I feel awesome. It is truly a life-changing thing. You're going to get variety. I don't think we've ever even had – I've been subscribing to Blue Apron for like 3 years now. I don't think we've ever had the same recipe twice. It's awesome. And always I'm surprised at these cool new ingredients that I've never heard of. It's delicious. It's good. And it's healthier than what you're probably eating now. Okay. So do you want to try it? I think you should. We're going to give you 3 meals for free – with free shipping. Shipping is always free with Blue Apron. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/DLC and you get 3 free meals for free. They know that you heard about it on our show, and it makes me happy because I think this is truly one of the greatest things ever. I really, truly love Blue Apron. You'll love how good you feel. You'll love how good it tastes. It's going to change your life. blueapron.com/DLC. All right, I am excited because Total Biscuit is here, and he is a board gamer, so you know what that means. It's time for tabletop time. TB, what have you gotten to the table recently?
Well, I did manage to get Potion Explosion onto the table after spending an hour assembling Potion Explosion. The reason that I bought the physical version of this after buying the iOS version was I thought the physical aspect of sliding marbles down tracks and having marbles fall onto other marbles and all that sort of thing would be quite enjoyable.
Delightful. And
it is. It is a nice little enjoyable experience. The main problem being that it comes in a box with about 20 stacks of cardboard, a lot of marbles, and an IKEA-like instruction set as to how to assemble this potion storage unit, which you feed marbles into. You have to manually bend the cardboard into slides that will actually fit and won't have the marbles get stuck on the way down. It's the sort of thing that I think would have worked a lot better if it had more premium-level components, but I understand they wanted to sell this thing for $30, $35, not $100. It's the kind of thing that I imagine a third-party company might make a premium dispenser for at some point, if right. There isn't one already. But the game was very enjoyable on iOS and turned out to be a hit on the table as well. Pretty easy to teach, simply because it's a very visual game.
It's basically Bejeweled, right? If you've played Bejeweled, you kind of get the core concept. And it's cool to have Bejeweled in a physical form. Like, you know, that visceral feeling of crashing down and creating new combos. It's like actually happening with marbles in front of you, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It does have the match three feel, although it's not 100% that. The idea of the game being that you have to create an explosion. And the way that you do that is by taking away a marble that already exists. So let's say I've got a bunch of marbles here. I take away this blue marble and two red marbles crash into the red marble that was below the blue marble. That causes an explosion. We take those away. Hey, did the one above that crash into another one of the same color? I get those too, if that's the case. And then you take those resources and you put them into potion vials, mix up the potions, complete the potions. That's how you score points. But rather than just being a point scoring method, which a lot of games do, they'll just go with a very generic run-of-the-mill scoring system. The scoring mechanism is also a power-up system. You can use a potion once per game to get a special effect, such as take all of the stored marbles that I have in my little auxiliary storage unit, which can store up to 3 marbles of any color, and put them into a potion regardless of their color, or steal from another player, or take all of the marbles from the bottom row as long as they're all different colors, that kind of thing. It's very fun to play. I'm very procedural. You've got to do things in the right order. And if you don't, then you'll end up with a suboptimal outcome. So teaching that can be a bit of a problem to players that don't really understand the idea of optimal procedure. But outside of that, it went down well. It was easy to teach. We had a good few games. It had good pacing to it. It was very enjoyable.
Very cool. Yeah, I've been playing the iOS version of Potion Explosion for a while now myself, and it's kind of funny that a game that seems to have clearly been inspired by those type of Bejeweled, Candy Crush type games. Like, it comes from a iOS type game into a cardboard form and then reimagined back into an iOS version. But as you might expect, it works really well as an iOS app. It delivers that exact kind of experience that you know, just takes care of all that fiddliness that you were kind of talking about for you, and you don't have to build the box. You don't have to worry about the marbles rolling away from you or fitting them back into the little top slot to make them go, you know, reassemble, all that stuff. It handles for you, which is cool. But it is missing, I think, what is a very fun tactile experience.
Yes, exactly. That physical aspect of the game does add quite a bit to it. There are benefits to playing a digital version, particularly since you don't have to wait for all the other players to take their turns. You know, if you want a quick round of it, you can spend as long as you like coming up with the best move possible and not have people glaring across the table at you waiting for you. So that's always nice. But you are right. You know, sliding marbles down in this thing is a lot of fun in and of itself, and hearing them clank together and then just grabbing them all and just having a fistful of marbles and getting as many potions as you can. Yeah, that is very fun.
It's one of those games where, you know, a lot of games, they feel very stingy with resources, and this game you really do like have a fistful of marbles at the end, and they're like, I can't even use all these, I got so many, it's so cool. You also have been playing Cult Express, right? It's another Asmodee game.
I do love me Cult Express, yes. Try to play that again physically. There is a digital version. We tried to play it. It's not very well implemented, particularly on PC. It might have the worst lobby system of any multiplayer game I've ever played. It has an invite system where if you don't accept the invite in 5 seconds, you can't come into the game and you have to remake the entire lobby to re-invite the guy.
Yikes.
It's actually awful. they really need to do something with that, but they have no real reason to, because it's shifted almost no copies on PC anyway, which is a shame. But as a board game, it's a lot of fun. Again, you've got that great tactile aspect of it, that it has a train that you put together and you can move onto the top of the train. It's a fully three-dimensional game, and moving on top of the train and running along the top and then diving into a carriage beneath is a legitimate strategy. And it's a game where learning the people at the table is maybe more important than learning the game itself. You want to try and figure out how aggressive is this guy and try and predict what he's going to be doing, and also keep track of the moves they've already made and try and program your moves so that they end up doing the right thing. And it all goes to hell, of course, at some point where you've forgotten where you actually are and you run straight into the marshal, get shot, and then swing at nothing as you programmed your character to punch next turn. So there's a lot. I think that the failure is the fun in that game, very much right. So. The screw-ups are where the laughs come from.
Yeah. It is. That game is a blast, and it's as if somebody created a rule set for what you would play as a kid anyway. Like, somebody has a toy train, and you got a couple of action figures. You, like, invent this game, and then this is sort of the codified version of that. It's really cool. And it's a game that if you see somebody playing it on a table, you're like, oh, what is that? That looks awesome. So, yeah, Cult Express and Potion Explosion, both of those are available as iOS apps. Asmodee is doing a big push on a lot of their games. In fact, I also had a chance to play Splendor as an iOS game.
Yes.
Splendor is one of my favorite and my wife's favorite tabletop games. It's a game I recommend to people when a lot of people are like, oh, I want a game for you know, people that have never played before or whatever. Splendor is so easy to teach. It is a cool, fun, quick strategy game. And it has really good, high quality components with these big, thick, like casino chip type tiles. And you're just kind of, you're acquiring gems and creating combos to get more powerful gems. And then if you have enough points, you can actually get patrons of this gem market to join your hand as well. And they all give you bonuses. Really cool game on the table, and a really cool implementation on iOS and Android as well. I've been playing a lot of it, actually, just sort of, you know, in time between times. But it plays great as a handheld. It's gorgeous. They did a really, really good job of bringing over the visuals of the game. It's vibrant and cool and colorful. So one I highly recommend as well if you want to spend a couple of bucks and try out a board game on your phone. All right, we can move on from tabletop time now. Let's move on to quick questions. But first, we do need to thank our final sponsor, and that is Gamefly. Oh my gosh, do you want to save money and actually play more games? Spend less, play more. That's the secret. Let me introduce you to Gamefly. Gamefly is the best way to buy and rent all of your favorite games. At Gamefly.com, all you got to do is pick your favorite game, and then they get mailed directly to your door. They have over 9,000 titles for you to choose from, and they let you try your favorite games and movies before you buy. You can keep the games as long as you want, and you never have to worry about late fees. You can cancel at any time. And now, Gamefly offers movie rentals too, so you can have a one-stop shop for all of your entertainment needs. Gamefly is how we actually review games. Christian uses Gamefly to review many of the games that we talk about on the show because it is a way to play more and actually have to spend less. We appreciate Gamefly very much for sponsoring the show, and we hope you give them a shot so that you're able to play all the great games you want for a fraction of the price. We'll hook you up. We'll give you a free trial, a free premium 30-day trial. All you got to do is go to gamefly.com/DLC. The premium trial allows you to try out two games and or movies at a time, and you can only get this offer by visiting gamefly.com/DLC. That DLC is very important. They know that you listen to our show, and that gets you that premium offer. So check it out, gamefly.com/DLC. Sign up, start playing all your favorite games for free for 30 days. gamefly.com/DLC. We have a bunch of quick questions that have come in. People are excited because if you sent in a quick question and we used it the last 3 weeks, including this one, you're getting a copy of Out of the Park Baseball, which is an award-winning baseball simulation game. You can simulate being a manager of a baseball team. And we're excited to be giving codes to all the people this week for that. But as I said, moving forward, we've had a bunch of people step up and send us codes. And we're going to continue to have quick questions be the way to get games, get free games. There are a bunch of mystery codes that we got. We got a bunch of episode one of Guardians of the Galaxy, the Telltale series. So the next foreseeable future, if you send us a quick question to to dlcfeedback@gmail.com or by posting it on our subreddit, 5x5dlc.reddit.com, in the stickied quick questions thread, you will get a free game. All right, let's get to it. Quick question. This comes from Richard Colby. He says, name a game that you are surprised isn't more popular. He be.
Well, I've been advocating for this one for a while, and I'll keep doing it until the end of time. Invisigun Heroes is a game that, as far as I'm concerned, ticks all the boxes for a really great competitive multiplayer party game. And it has full online support, lobbies, everything you could possibly need, and a very unique setup in which you are all invisible. And by all, I mean including you. You can't see where you are, and that's actually the point. You have to sneak around, and the only time that you ever appear is when you shoot your Invisigun. You appear briefly on the screen. So you use it not only to kill your opponents, but also to kind of locate where you are and not lose track of where that may be. And if you end up bumping into a wall, it will appear for people. If you end up, say, walking through the snow, you'll leave footprints to give people indications as to where you are.
It seems like an update to the old mode in Combat.
Oh, yeah.
2600 game. You know, there was
back there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's old school. But if you kept hitting select on your Atari 2600, there was like infinity different combat modes. And one of them was everybody was invisible.
Yeah. It takes that concept just to a ludicrous extent and has an incredible selection of levels, over 50 levels, all with their own different gimmicks, a huge amount of game modes, I think at least 8 different game modes, and 8 different playable characters that all have their own abilities. Really great pixel art, awesome music, great online system. It's barely hit the radar of anybody. There's like 4 people playing it right now, according to Steam charts. It had an all-time peak of 42, and that's when myself and a bunch of streamers did a big push on it. It just didn't resonate with people for whatever reason, and maybe it just shows something of a disconnect between those of us that play an awful lot of video games and were desperate to find something new and interesting and original and have a group of people that also are looking for that, and your regular gaming populace that are saying, well, I'm not going to pay $15 for a game where I can't even see myself.
Yeah. All right, that's Invisigun Heroes. Christian, how about you? Name a game your surprise isn't more popular.
my go-to for years was always Jet Set Radio, but I feel like nostalgia has pulled that one back, even though I don't know if it plays that well. Like the Vita, I'm like, oh, this game was lived and died in its time. But that was always my, a lot of Dreamcast era games I was the champion of. I loved my Dreamcast. So I feel like now people might say they're fans of it, even though it never really sold well. A game you can go out and buy right now that I don't think did as well as it should have is Not a Hero, which is, I believe, Roll 7. It's the closest, I think, to kind of a John Wick pixel art experience you can get, where you're running, gunning, sliding, popping out. It has a very bizarre story behind it, where, you know, the person you're working for is probably someone you shouldn't be working for, but it's really fun. You can play it with a retro controller if you have one, and it plays really, really well. So I like Not a Hero a lot. What about you?
I mentioned this last week, but it is my go-to. I don't understand why this wasn't a massive franchise that had multiple iterations, and that's Darksiders. I know they had one sequel, but I don't think either of them sold particularly well, and you don't hear people talking about Darksiders. It was that, like, adult Zelda thing that I always wanted. It was a high-definition Zelda before we ever got high-definition Zelda. It was it had a really cool art style. Joe Madera did the character designs. It was awesome. I loved it. And the sequel, like, added loot to the mix. These are great games, and I don't know why they aren't held in higher esteem. I think they deserve
it. Sequel somewhat foreshadowing, you know, the loot system that was added. Things, oh, Zelda with loot. Oh, wait. You know, that's now the case. That it was interesting to play Darksiders 1 and very much think that this is the kind of Ocarina of Time equivalent, and then go on to Darksiders 2, which had a bit more of an open world that you could ride around on your horse. It had that loot and played maybe a little bit more like Majora's Mask or like Twilight Princess or something along those lines. And it really was the Dark Zelda. Great cast of characters, awesome combat system in general. Certainly deserved far more acclaim than it got. Just came out at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I know a lot of people just thought it was a God of War knockoff, which really was not.
Yeah. That first game, like the first intro level, the combat system felt like God of War, and people were like, it's a lame God of War. But no, it's Zelda. It's Zelda.
Totally Zelda. They've got a hookshot and everything. It's Zelda, no doubt.
All right, a quick question. This comes from NF Portal. He says, do you think that battles you are supposed to lose in role-playing games are okay? TB.
That's a tricky one. The reason being that I do believe storytelling through gameplay is the strongest form of storytelling that you can get in a video game. I would much rather play the story than watch the story. If I want to watch a story, I'd go see a movie. I'm not the world's biggest fan of cutscenes, certainly. I'll happily skip them. The problem, of course, with battles that you're supposed to lose is the contrivance, the fact that you are not really the one as the player telling the story here. The story is going to have the same result regardless of what you do. I like it when you lose, but there is some recognition for you perhaps doing better than you were supposed to. This may point out that I don't know a great deal about Dark Souls or whatever, but if I recall correctly, a lot of people said, oh, you know, the Asylum Demon, originally people assumed you couldn't beat the Asylum Demon. It was either, or actually the first boss in Demon Souls, maybe, not Dark Souls, maybe even going further back than that. And most players would die on that, and then they'd wake up as the undead. But some players were good enough to beat that boss, and then they'd go on to a bit where they would die. They would have to die eventually. But you had this sort of success state before the hard failure state.
Right.
And I think if you do it that way, if you recognize some degree of success before slapping you down and saying, no, you have to lose here, then I think that's a good way of storytelling and also giving you that satisfaction through gameplay because of your mechanical prowess or your particular strategic choices.
Yeah. Yeah, the surprise of, oh, I was supposed to die here, to me is never satisfying enough to make up for the frustration during the, why can't anything I do anything to this guy? Yeah. So I don't think it's a valuable experience to give to the player. Like, okay, oh, well, big twist. I was supposed to die. All right. Okay, I guess I'm feeling like an idiot for the last 20 minutes. This gives no reason for it.
Yeah, it's kind of a waste of time. It's like, was I just hitting X over and over again when I could have watched a cutscene here? Yeah. Is that really what ruined it? A lot of These games do solve that issue through QuickTime events, probably one of the better uses of QTEs in particular. Asura's Wrath, a great example of a game where, yes, there are fights that you lose, but you're losing fights with planet-sized enemies, and the way that you're doing that in itself is satisfying. You felt like, you know, you struggled and you tried, but it wasn't going to happen.
Christian, you on the same tip here?
I think it can be done well. I think most of the time it's not, but I feel like that's most things in games. You know, going back to Call of Duty, whatever it was, one of the warfares, you know, press X to mourn, which I know isn't this, but it's like,
press X that's to like pay saying, respect. Yes.
Like when you have to push X to interact with things in a game. I guess, yes, right? But here's a really bad example of it. I think this has led to cool things, and there are cool instances of it. I think to some extent Metal Gear Solid 4's radiation tunnel was led out of this idea of you're supposed to die, but like it's giving you the experience to the player in a way that you're supposed to feel like that, I think. Like when it's done well, you're supposed to feel frustrated and because that's what's happening. You know, it's right. You as the character experiencing the same emotion. And I think that's a cool way that video games can pull it off. Most recently, the thing I think did it well was slight spoiler for a fairly recent game, last year game. If you don't want to know anything about it, it's literally the first thing you do in Battlefield 1. But it kind of telegraphs it too. It says in war you die, or whatever it is, in that first opening moment where you're down in the trenches and you die and you spawn as someone else and then die and spawn as someone else, and it's just like
powerful.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Was I thought epic and really cool and setting the stage for what that game was going to be. So it's hard for me to say I don't like it when last year I played a moment that, you know, blew my mind in it being cool.
Was that moment all completely forgotten when you became Iron Man in the episode 3, however, in the Italian mountains? Because it bloody well was for me.
That was episode 3. You can't hold episodes accountable to each other just because they're in the same narrative.
Absolutely not, yes.
All right, quick question. This comes from Kyle Wasco. He says, do you finish more games now than you used to? 5 years ago? 10 years ago?
Absolutely not, without question. If I finish a game, it's probably because that game was 4 hours long or less, or in a very rare circumstance that it was something that I got so incredibly engrossed into and hooked into that I actually did invest the time. I think the last game that I beat of any significant length was XCOM 2 last year, Doom as well, but that probably was about it. Yeah. Most of them I don't. I don't even feel the need to most of the time because I'm not a very narratively driven person. I don't really care about the end of the story. I cared about the gameplay, what I'd done up to that point, and whether or not I got satisfaction out of it through that.
Christian, how about you?
I'd say about the same. What has changed over the years is that I start way more games. The amount of games that I beat has remained consistent, but... I start and play more games. I think more games come out and there are more interesting experiences that I want to dip my toe into. So I'll maybe start, you know, whatever it is, 100 games a year, but I'm still only beating, you know, 15 to 25 or whatever that is. I mean, MOBAs have to have wrecked this for you, Jeff. You can't beat it, right?
Can't beat it. Keep trying. I'm like 3,500 games into Heroes of the Storm, and for some reason, there's no end credits, guys. No end credits.
You're almost at Act 2. Don't worry.
I think that I have given myself permission not to finish things more now than I used to. If the game is truly exceptional, I can't wait to I mean Horizon Zero Dawn, I ate it up. But there are games that I used to force myself to slog through just to be able to say I finished it, and now I don't do that to myself anymore because there's Heroes of the Storm to be played. So
it's very much a privilege if you have the money or you happen to have the access, in our case maybe, that we don't pay for our games, that right. Yes, we will not finish something that we're not enjoying unless we absolutely have to for our job, you know, unless it dictates that we must. Why waste the time? There are far too many good video games out there waiting to be explored. We know we'll never get to all of them. Why waste the time on something that you're not actually engaged in?
I couldn't
Someone
say better. That's perfect.
Print that, make it a poster, have a kitty cat hang it on a tree if we need to. Those are the truest words I think ever said. Yeah. They need to be repeated every so often.
Quick question, although this one, I don't think you understand this.
Yeah, this is not a quick question, Jeff.
I'm going to summarize. Like, this comes from James in Vermont. He basically said that he and his friends back in 2002 were playing Outside the Park Baseball 3, and they decided to create a gigantic like fake league with that took place in the 80s, complete with its own website where that they would update with stories and a fake news, you know, like a beat reporter talking about the league and all this stuff. And he said they got really, really into it to the point where he like felt almost an obligation that bordered on work. And it actually ruined the fun of the game because he had like committed himself to this intense job. So he says, quick question. Have you ever added your own systems to a video game and gotten carried away with it?
TV. To a video game? Very much back in the day, we used to put arbitrary rules into our Dota games. And by Dota, I'm talking Dota 1 here. Dota All-Stars, Warcraft 3. We had a group of people on a TeamSpeak that we'd play with. We wouldn't play really with anyone outside of that group. So it became this very strange insular echo chamber whereby we had dictated certain honorable ways upon which we will play Dota. And there are these dishonorable ways that they will not be tolerated. So ganking beyond a certain point, that will not be tolerated. You will stay in your lane for X amount of time. You will not play about half the heroes on the roster because we deem them overpowered. And you will not buy this item or that item. If a Divine Reaper is dropped, you will give the player 20 seconds to pick it up again. And all this other complete nonsense that basically ruined the game entirely, but we were too stupid to know that. We restricted ourselves so much that we ruined the whole concept of the game, and it took playing with another group and realizing that ganking and lane rotation is part of the game, and as is great hero composition, to truly break out of that mindset. It was awful. I would never recommend imposing those ridiculous rules on yourself ever.
Yeah, I think the takeaway from all of this is don't do this. But Christian, did you do this?
Well, I think a lot of it's been codified now into games. But as an older gentleman, as a gamer in my mid-30s of experience taste, we would do things like this where whether or not it was playing GoldenEye, don't look at the other person's screen. You know, like, you can't peek. That's not a thing in the game, but you're saying don't do that. Or no playing as odd job. You're not allowed to select odd job. No one can play as him. In Halo, we would say no rockets on Hang 'em High because that would just totally, you know, it was just a rush to the rockets. We liked that map played without rockets. We found a lot of fun. So we would have a lot of things like that let in games. But now I feel like so many games have custom, you know, switches that you can throw to create your own custom maps that it doesn't feel like you're creating them because the game gives you options, even achievements now. I remember Geometry Wars 1 way back in the day, you know, like one of the first achievements for that was pacifist, and it was just survive for 60 seconds or whatever it was without firing a shot. And that was the type of thing that I would do with like Galaga or Centipede, you know. Yeah. You would just be at the arcade and say like, okay, I know I'm never going to get the high score on this. So you and your buddies would see how long you could just live without doing anything. And now a lot of that's in games. I love that stuff. But yeah, it's so easy to go too far, like anything in life, right? Moderation.
Yeah, there's two parts to that, isn't there? There's the idea of the custom games and creating your own challenges. And then there's house ruling because you have to, especially with a lot of these older games, because Oddjob's a great example. In a modern game, Oddjob would have been patched within 2 weeks of launch. It's obvious, but in the era of cartridges where that couldn't have happened, Oddjob is a relic of a time when this company did not consider proper multiplayer balance. And as a result, you know, you don't play that character anymore. And it's accepted that you don't. For a while, I believe it may still even be, there was a version of Street Fighter 2 in which Akuma is banned on the competitive scene because the game was never properly designed and balanced to use Akuma. It was impossible.
A treat in arcades. Yeah, like,
yeah, something
play as this overpowered beast.
Yeah, but these days, with such a focus on the competitive side of things and everything having online multiplayer, those sort of things, they don't survive longer than a couple of weeks most of the time. So those sort of house rules for necessity are no longer required.
Yeah. I have a few examples of this. We used to play StarCraft and we had our, we had walkie talkies. We had a, Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock walkie talkies. Stone Cold was one, Rock was the other. And we would, we only communicate because we were living in an apartment together. My roommate and I would play in two different rooms and we would only communicate through The Rock and the Stone Cold walkie talkies to, cause there was no, VoIP at that point.
No.
The other one, you know, it was great in college. College was awesome. Lived in a house with seven dudes. There was like one PlayStation 2 and one what was it? N64, I guess, would be the time period. Not GameCube yet, N64. And we would have all these ridiculously asinine rule sets for how the games were played, because there was only one controller and seven dudes. So it was like life or level was a big one of, you know, you get to play until you die or next level. Or when we were playing Ocarina of Time, for example, one person would be the controller. Everybody else would get to weigh in on how the puzzles were done. And one person would read all the text out loud, except for when there was like a different color, because they would do like red words. And then a third person would say the red words. It was all stupid, idiot stuff to entertain ourselves. But man, those were good days. Those were good days. Thank you all for sending in your quick questions. We appreciate that. Again, if you want to send them in for next week, it's dlcfeedback@gmail.com or on our subreddit. We're going to wrap the show up now because Total Biscuit has to get going. But we do have a parting gift coming up. And I think Christian and I are going to stick around a little bit and talk VR talk, because I do want to talk about Rick and Morty. But we'll do that after we let him go. But in the meantime, Total Biscuit, thank you so much for being here. We very much appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Great to be on a show of, I wouldn't say those from kind of a past era of games media, because I don't think that era has passed, but I think there was a very interesting era of games media where people like me grew up, or at least during college, were kind of watching things like Tech TV and G4 and the older school kind of podcasts. Let's say before the Twitch generation. That's probably the best way to describe it. Before the Twitch and YouTube generation. That's the kind of thing that I used to listen to and model my own shows on. So it's great to be a part of one of those.
Oh, thanks.
That was the best compliment and way to call us poor.
I really appreciate it. But that's okay.
Don't worry,
I'm getting there. No doubt.
We'll take it. Where can people, I mean, I'm sure people know about you, but where can people keep up with your stuff online?
If you want to have a look at my YouTube channel, which is primarily where the Co-optional podcast has its VODs, which is our weekly gaming video podcast show. It's also where I do my game critiques, previews, and first impressions. You can find that all over on youtube.com/cynicalbrit. That is youtube.com/cynicalbrit. The StarCraft tournaments that I hold on a monthly basis, all of the video on demand is available on my second channel, youtube.com/totalbiscuit. If you like the idea of competitive StarCraft that is explained by people who are not using a ton of jargon and has a very exciting, interesting format where one loss and that professional player from South Korea is out on his ass, well, we have that too. That's all available on youtube.com/totalbiscuit. My Twitter, I would not recommend you follow, but if you happen to be a masochist of some sort, then twitter.com/totalbiscuit, and I do stream occasionally, including tomorrow for the Co-optional podcast at 3 p.m. Eastern. That's on twitch.tv/totalbiscuit, and that's certainly something I'd love to have both of you guys on if you ever have spare time amongst the million and one podcasts that you seem to put out on a weekly basis. We'd love to have you on the other side of the fence.
Absolutely.
That'd be awesome.
We'd love it. Christian, how about you? What do you got going on this week?
Oh, this week, God, who knows? Who knows what's happening this week? What I'm excited about is I have 3 gigs booked and on the books in the calendars for when I'm in the UK at the end of June. That'll be fun. So if you're out there, the best way, I'll post all that stuff, Twitter or my website. Twitter is at Spicer, website christianspicer.com. It'll be my first time doing stand-up in the UK. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. And then album out, my newest album, We're All Gonna Die. You can find it on iTunes and all that stuff. And then if you want just a little extra geeky goodness, I do a small little Patreon-only feed called At Least 20 More Minutes, which you can find at patreon.com/Christian Spicer. And it's usually just a 20-minute deeper dive into something we kind of talk about on this show that I didn't have time to really talk about. I did Style Over Substance as one. Last week, I really just dove into the trailers for Battlefront 2 and Last Jedi, which I know that trailer doesn't exist in Jeff's world yet.
No trailers exist in my world, Christian.
I'm actually on Jeff's side on that one, I'm afraid. I don't watch trailers anymore. It ruins everything.
Bravo.
I watch a tone trailer is what I call it. So if I hear that it's kind of that tone trailer, that
first
teaser.
What do you need to know about Star Wars to make you go see it, Christian? Just, you know?
Well, I'm so well-versed in this director's take on the Star Wars universe that I guess nothing. I need to know how this is going to be handled. Is this George Lucas?
You're
is
going
this
anyway. You're going. Pretty? Just go. Just see the movie. Anyway, moving on.
Okay. Well, I'm no longer going to see the movies. Only watch trailers from this point forward. I don't want to be sullied, and the movies give everything away. So.
They do. The movies do give away all the stuff that's in the trailers.
And I think I said Twitter's already the best way to keep in touch. So that's it. Stand Up is an album. We're All Gonna Die. I'll be in the UK in June. San Diego, May 9th. Austin, I think, around Labor Day. and then at least 20 more minutes. Jeff, what about you?
I got lots of stuff for you to listen to. If you want to hear me talk more about video games, I do a daily show on Anchor. It's just 10 minutes a day, every single day, 7 days a week. You can find that at anchor.fm/NLB for newest, latest, best. I also do a movie and television review show called the Slash Filmcast. You can find that at /filmcast.com. This week we're talking about the phenomenal Free Fire. You should really go see that movie. It's awesome. And then I also do We Have Concerns, which is a comedy science show with Anthony Carboni. You can find that at wehaveconcerns.com. All right, guys, let's wrap up this portion of the show with our parting gift. Hey, give us a suggestion. Total Biscuit, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Something non-gaming related. I like to try and shoehorn wrestling into every show that I'm on when I can.
Love it.
Which can be tricky and sometimes obnoxious, but there is a little go-to that I happen to have, which thankfully is now available on Netflix, which makes it a lot easier to recommend. So let me set the scene for you for a second. Let's say you haven't watched wrestling probably in 10, 15, 20 years. You perhaps remember the days of The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, absurd storylines, The Undertaker rising from the grave, Kane setting people on fire. The absurdity of wrestling. Well, the absurdity of wrestling is alive and well in a series headed up by some of the most unlikely people. Executive producer Mark Burnett, who is responsible for shows like Celebrity Apprentice, Survivor, and Shark Tank, has, I believe, won 10 Emmys or some ludicrous number. And, of course, the legendary Robert Rodriguez, of all people, behind Machete, Predators, and, of course, Dust Till Dawn, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, Desperado trilogy. Yeah. They decided they'd make a wrestling show. Huh. Because why not? And they decided that they would make it very much themed in the style of a Latino gangster series with grimy vignettes and strange goings on. And it starts off appearing to be something of just an underground enterprise with dirty money and money laundering. Then dragons are involved in some way. And things get a little bit weird, culminating at the end of every season with their giant tournament called Aztec Warfare. This is a really strange but very enjoyable and different take on wrestling. It's a great introduction to the art of lucha, which is perhaps something that most people outside of Mexico have really not had much contact with. And if you are up for some absurd and some ludicrous storylines and insane characters, accompanied, of course, by what is essentially some of the best live stunts on television, then check out Lucha Underground. The first few series are available on Netflix. It's one hell of a show, let me put it that way. You will not see anything quite like it.
Awesome, dude. I gotta check that out. I didn't know it was on Netflix. That's so great. Christian, how about you? You got a parting gift?
Another Star Wars book coming at you. Timothy Zahn's new who's done it all. His new book is Thrawn. Zahn writing Thrawn, who's a fan favorite, I think a well-deserved fan favorite Star Wars character. Some of the fan favorites, Boba Fett, aren't worthy of.
You know, this has to be good because he was just inviting people to write Zahn's Thrawn is a yawn. So it's got to be good, right?
It is no yawn. I'm maybe 10 chapters in. It's awesome. I like, you know, well-written Star Wars books. There are certainly some that aren't as great, but I think Timothy Zahn has certainly, you know, proved his merit over the years. And
I haven't read one that's bad on his regard.
Yeah, right?
You know, it's just incredible.
It's hit after hit. He understands the world and the lore and how to write it, you know, when you're reading it and not seeing the stuff on screen. And it's such an interesting book. Maybe, you know, it switches some way, but Thrawn is such a bad hombre, but to make him the protagonist in a book where you're kind of rooting for this guy that you know, depending on what you know about the character, is going to just destroy things. It's really cool, and it gives me hope, actually, that Battlefront 2's protagonist could maybe actually be someone who doesn't have to be secretly good, and they could do this, you know, dark, evil person as a protagonist and make that compelling. But it's the Star Wars Thrawn book by Timothy Zahn.
I already mentioned going to see Free Fire. It did not do well at the box office. That's a crime. It is a really, really great movie. You can listen to the Slash Filmcast to hear us talk about why. But I also want to mention I got a I jumped in, guys. I upgraded my sound system in my house. I got a Sonos Playbase. The Playbase is their brand new alternative to a sound bar. It's a sound bar, but it has like a full base that you can like set a television on. I don't set my television on it, but I do love how it sounds. It's got that full Sonos capability of being able to like modularly add more speakers, so I can eventually have full surround by adding a couple other of their speakers. But it will play, you know, every sound online music service known to man through your phone, and it will eventually have like Alexa integration, Amazon Echo integration. I really like it. It was a huge upgrade. Not cheap. These things are very expensive, but I really really dig mine, so I can recommend it. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. We have more stuff coming up, so don't go away. But that's the end of our time with Total Biscuit. So thank you so much again, Total Biscuit and Christian Spicer, for hanging out. Thanks to all the folks who listened to the show live with us on Twitch. We appreciate you hanging out and contributing to the show in real time. We appreciate all of you that have downloaded the show. We will be back next week with more content. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place. We got bonus content coming at you, and it is one of our regular segments, Bonus VR Talk.
Virtual reality. VR. Virtual reality. Just VR.
Not Christian's this week, because he doesn't think he has enough space to play this game, but he really wants to VR.
You really should, dude. It's so fun. You like Rick and Morty, right?
No, I hate it. I hate everything that they've ever created. I think it's a travesty. I don't even like what it's based on. Back to the Future, it's just like, just garbage.
But you watched all of Rick and Morty.
I literally, so yes, I want to play
this game. It is a work of genius. It is a work of genius. The Rick and Morty show is so good. It's so good. Anyway, so this is like official Rick and Morty virtual Rickality is what it's called. And it got all the voice actors. It's written by the right people. It's
the Wright brothers?
The right people, yeah.
Oh, the right people. I got it. Mm-hmm. Property Brothers?
The coolest, the first thing you do when you put on your goggles and start this game is you appear in Rick's garage. And that in and of itself is amazing, dude. You're like standing in the garage where he does all his experimentation, seen it on the show.
And so I've looked forever. At screens. Is it polygonal? Like, how does the world capture in VR? Because it's very much Rick and Morty's not South Park, but you know what I mean? It's like, I remember when the South Park game came to the N64 and the characters were polygonal at first and it was not quite right.
It is a little of that. It's more like, you ever played like a Simpsons video game? Mm-hmm. You know, it's that. It's like, oh, this 2D thing has become 3D and I can see around the corner and stuff. I mean, it feels like you stepped into the cartoon. It's cool.
And they've done 3D episodes, certainly. Like, they've 3D created 3D models for their character, so it's not unheard of. But okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's not
like Papercraft, though.
Yeah, yeah. It feels cool. It feels awesome that you're standing, and it's all, you know, even better than playing a Simpsons video game where you're like, oh, cool, I can walk around Springfield. In this one, you're standing and everything is one-to-one. It's all proportionally the right size to you, and you're standing inside it because of VR. It's really cool. And the conceit is that you have been created by Rick and you are a Morty clone. You're a disposable Morty that he created to – you start the game and he's like, oh, good. I've made you Morty. Here you are. Okay. I want you to do some laundry while we go and have an adventure. This is the laundry. Do it. And you like the first thing you have to do is literally like do his laundry because he created you to be his slave. And you have, you know, he hands the laundry to you.
Does it do your real laundry too? So at least I'm getting something out of it.
No, man. But you know, like you open the door of the washing machine and you put the laundry. I mean, it's all physical. You're manipulating things. You have little hands, but then they leave, right? Rick and Morty go through a portal and leave, and they leave you in the garage. And now you can teleport around to different nodes in the garage. And it's basically job simulator or, accounting. It's, you know, you're fiddling with things, and eventually you'll find instructions, and Rick has certain things that he wants you to do. And once you start doing those things, surprises happen. But there's so many great inside jokes from the show. Just the stuff on his shelves in his, you know, or on his workbench or whatever, it's just full of stuff. And all that's the awesome. Stuff is from the shows. And you can pick all of it up and use all of it. And they all it all does surprising things or funny, stupid things. And, you know, like the back of something will have a fun thing written on it that you recognize from the show. And it's just that wish fulfillment of being inside a Rick and Morty episode is already a joy. And then the sort of puzzle of, you know, it's kind of it's like an escape room or something, you know. This is, the game isn't – there's nothing – it's nothing – it's not, you know, Resident Evil 7 here. It's not a big, robust AAA game. It's a small experience, but it is a delightful experience that doesn't outstay its welcome. It has tons of really funny surprises that happen. And you're given a surprising amount of freedom within that limitation of the escape room. You know, he's got this thing called a what's it called? Like a replicator or a combinator. I think it's called a combinator. So you put – there's three pads, right? You put – one thing on the first pad, a second thing on the second pad, and then they combine and it creates a third thing that is the combination of two. And there's a bunch of crap in his house that you can like put on this combinator. And a lot of the puzzles are about using the combinator. But, you know, like for example, if you have an apple and a beer can, it creates like a metal apple. So it's fun to just sort of do that and then throw those things around. I mean, it's simplistic, but there's enough funny, fun stuff around that it is so worth doing.
Makes you sound like it sounds great, but it also I feel like I'll be like, oh come on, since I'm so deep in these two adventure games right now, I want the full adventure game version of it, right? Where I'm creating the meat key or whatever I need to do to open the door to do the thing.
Yeah, I mean it's got some of that, right? It's very Simon Says at a certain point, like you just have to do what you find little clues and you just have to do them. So it's not, you know, it's not gonna, you know, reinvent the wheel in any way, but it's still just so great. And it's cool that an IP as awesome as Rick and Morty is doing this in VR, and it makes fun of VR a lot, and it makes fun of itself. And there's a point where you can make a Mr. Meeseeks look at me, and he'll like mimic all your actions. So you can like throw him somewhere, and then if you look over, like he's doing what your hands and head are doing. It's just delightful, dude. It's so good.
I feel like that's kind of how, you know, VR is best for a lot of things that I like. Are, you know, it's like, oh, they're not full AAA games, they're just experiences. I'm okay with that. I'm not saying I don't want, like, there's rumors there might be a bigger, you know, VR experience in Battlefront 2, and I certainly would love that. But Batman Arkham VR was a great experience. And this, just to put you in that world, it's these little experiences like this that prove the idea that VR itself is the killer app. And not the killer app, right? Like it doesn't need Uncharted 5 to sell the thing. It's that you can do this thing for 2 hours and have it be so fun that right. alone justifies the thing.
Yeah, Global Reset in the chat agrees. He said the humor's all there from the show and he loved it. And I totally agree with you. And by the way, Batman comes out tomorrow.
I know.
For Vive and Oculus.
What did you play Rick and Morty on?
Vive.
Okay, because it's both, right? I think it's both.
It's both, yeah.
Okay.
But I played it on Vive as I knew it was room scale, and I figured it would be better to have it on the full Vive room scale-y.
Yeah.
Room scale.
Yep.
It's delightful. And I can see your worry about it taking up a lot of room because there are these – you can't teleport anywhere you want. You know, a lot of games you just point at the ground and teleport to that spot. This one you have to – there's like these nodes that you can teleport, and within the node you move around quite a bit. So it does take a little bit of room, but –
I just read a couple of reviews that were people said like it takes more room than Raw Data or Robo Recall, and I can play both of those, but I definitely, you know, hit things when I let myself go.
Well, I still have gotten to the point now where I like tentatively move my arm forward even when I feel like I've got plenty of room. I'm not going to just jut my arm forward yet.
Yeah. See, I have the you know, the safety wall on or whatever.
Why? But
no, I have to have it off. It's only shows up on the floor because I have it on to show everywhere. It's always on. Like, that's how small my space is. So I'm constantly in that Lawnmower Man grid world. Right. So I only have it marked on the floor. So if I look down, I can kind of see where I am. But otherwise, I'm punching my TV. You've been in the space. It's a small space. So.
It is. Yeah. I get it. But I think you should still try it because it's so fun.
And it's only 2 hours, so put your kid down for a nap and invite me over, dude. And my friend, who also lives out there, just bought an awesome, I won't say who it is, but he bought, I think it's a 95 or 96 911, the last year of air-cooled. It only has like 20,000 original miles on it. Anyway, what I'm saying is I'm willing to drive out to your neck of the woods.
I missed all that last stuff because I kind of nodded off there a little bit. But VR, I'm excited to do.
Well, picture a scorching red VR headset. Yeah. That's the collector's edition that only has 4 hours of eyes on you so far.
Oh, wow. That sounds awesome. Does it have cool software?
Yeah, it's a six game manual.
thanks for translating into my language for me. I appreciate it. All right. I thought it was great having Total Biscuit on. He's a good guy. I appreciated that. All right. That's it for the bonus content. I just wanted to talk about that. I played another virtual reality game, but the embargo doesn't come up until 7 a.m. tomorrow, so I can't talk about it yet.
Well, where could people hear daily content from you?
My Anchor show called Newest, Latest, Best. I'll definitely be talking about that tomorrow, and that's anchor.fm/NLB. All right, guys, have a good one.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.